the war against classic literature. English literature has been hijacked and deconstructed on campus. Like every other aspect of Western civilization, English literature is under relentless assault today. In all too many universities, English professors, and I use that in inverted commas and italics, seem to be teaching almost anything and everything except classical English literature. And this is a great concern to myself because my oldest daughter, Andrea, has been very much into English literature since she was very young. Her mother would regularly come and complain that she is caught reading Shakespeare at 11 o'clock at night under the blankets with a torch. And, you know, your 10-year-old's wanting to read Shakespeare at 11 at night, why would I want to punish her? I mean, that's just great, outstanding. But where could she study English literature? Not in any of our university campuses. Because the university campuses are teaching you everything except English literature. The English literature department, the English department's normally the worst department on any campus. Many have enrolled in English class at university, found themselves studying Marxist theory, Marxist political and economic theory, and investigation of pornography through the ages, for goodness sakes. The gender theories of Freud, Latin culture, I thought we were studying English, feminist theories, deconstructionism, lesbianism, misogyny, tirades against racism, sexism, colonialism, homophobia, and a bewildering array of other radical postmodern political agendas. By the way, don't you like this order? For there are more than two genders, but there's only two types. There's men and women in the order form. Is that ironic or what? This has led to an increasing public demand for shallow, sensational, superficial, vile, violent, debased, and disgusting content. Albert Einstein said, "I fear the day that technology will surpass our human interaction. The world will then have a generation of idiots." And is that not true? You can literally see this at dinner tables. I've been on dates with my wife, and we look around the restaurant and you see other couples out on dates sitting there, not even looking or speaking to one another, but on their phones. What are people doing in the middle of an art gallery looking at their phones? We are increasingly in the dark. Many politically correct professors in English departments so despise and fear Western civilization that those enrolling to learn more of English literature are more likely to find themselves assailed with bankrupt ideologies than to be exposed to some of the greatest literature in Western civilization. Instead of subjecting oneself to anti-Christian indoctrination in so-called English departments, more like indoctrination gulags, of secular university students would immeasurably enrich the experience and education by going directly to the works of Charles Dickens and Jane Austen, John Milton, William Shakespeare, John Bunyan, Geoffrey Chaucer, George Orwell, C.S. Lewis, and other greats of English literature. The most effective propaganda machine in human history has been the television, and what that has done to destroy a lot of our civilization is incalculable. I know that because I'm one of the last of the generation that was brought up without TV. I was brought up in a home where we read books and played chess at night. And then I remember when I was converted, 1977, television had just come into South Africa. And when I was converted in 1977, the Pines Baptist Church that I was converted through, they had a men's prayer meeting on Tuesday night where virtually all the men in the church attended. That's just big. The church looked pretty full. And on Thursday night, they had an evangelism explosion meeting, and we'd be going out and doing door-to-door every Thursday night. And we were delivering Gospels of John into every one of the 4,500 homes in Pines. And do you know, at the beginning, virtually every home would open the door. You didn't have to worry about gates, intercom, security, this, that. No, you walk straight up the path to the door, knocked on the door, come on in, sit down, have some tea, and we'd chat. People might turn the radio off or the gramophone, but you would actually sit in the homes of strangers and discuss the gospel, and people were open to this. But by the next year, 1978, this had become impossible. They suspended the men's prayer meeting because it clashed with rich man, poor man, and they suspended the EE door-to-door because it clashed with the world at war. And it's been temporarily suspended for the last 41 years. since 1978. That's quite a long temporary suspension. So television, I saw take a Bible-believing, book-reading, evangelistic community and turn it into a bunch of gogglebox watchers whose brains are getting stuck in a box. And it's terrible. It has destroyed our culture in South Africa. I remember at the time that I came from Rhodesia, our Minister of Telecommunications, his surname was Hertzog. He's presumably related to James Barry Hertzog, the very popular Prime Minister of many years ago. But he was always depicted as very verklempte in black, looked like mourning outfit of an undertaker with a tall black hat. And not that I think he ever dressed like that, but that's the way the cartoons depicted him. And I remember him saying, as long as I'm Minister of Telecommunications, we will not have TV in South Africa. If TV comes to South Africa, it's going to increase racial tensions. It will lead to violence. There will be a decrease in respect for law and order, an increase in crime and violence. It will undermine race relations. He said, and he was being ridiculed for this. They were comic people, comedians were all the time taking the mickey out of this man. Minister Hertzog, because he was against television. And South Africa is one of the last civilized Christian societies left on the planet. And this curse of television that came in here destroyed what was once a very God-honoring country. I remember coming to South Africa and being struck by just how many Christians there were everywhere. Because I came from this non-Christian, secular family where we never went to church. And suddenly in South Africa, everyone seemed to go to church. And just at Pines High School, more than half, something like two-thirds of the school were part of the Christian Union. And the Christian Union camp was massive. It was almost as big as the church, as the school camp. So on Sunday, the only place there was to go to was church. And people went in droves. And when I went to Pines Baptist, would you believe, 1977, all the women of whatever age, hats, gloves, stockings, dresses, all the males of every age, ties, jackets, and so on, polished shoes. The average kid dressed better than the average pastor does today. The entire culture of South Africa changed after the television came in. And I don't think people realize just how much it has destroyed so much of what was good and beautiful and noble and outstanding about South Africa. We used to be a fitter, stronger, healthier, more neighborly country before this cursed, blasted, damned, satanic altar television came in. To show you how bad things are going, this is Norwich Cathedral in Britain, and they installed a helter skelter. Yep, that's members of the church there. Notice this apostate wearing the clerical collar here. And this is Norwich Cathedral, helter skelter. They think this is an intelligent thing to do. Well, fortunately, there was quite a bit of opposition. And the bishop admitted it was a bad idea and it's been dismantled since. But the fact that anybody is this idiotic, that instead of preaching the word of God and singing the great hymns and having Handel's Messiah performed in the cathedral, they think a helter-skelter thing is this why people go to church now? Well, of course, it doesn't reverse the fact that people are pouring out of churches in Britain. When you don't preach the gospel, the Holy Spirit doesn't cooperate. But English literature is a treasure of Western civilization, and it's under attack. A study of the great classics of English literature is absolutely essential to a true education. The English classics have played a key role in teaching individual virtue and laying foundations for Western civilization. Reading the works of William Shakespeare, John Milton, John Bunyan, Jane Austen, and Charles Dickens helps us exercise our minds and enrich our experiences. It's gym for the mind. Great Christian literature enables us to recognize truths, appreciate beauty, and admire what is virtuous. The literary classics include drama that purges our minds with breathtaking intensity, heartbreaking pathos and poetry that makes us hunger and thirst after virtue and courage. Good literature enables us to recognize what is truly beautiful and honorable. It also shapes our character by teaching us to despise what is dishonorable, to love what is noble, and to aspire to high standards in our own lives. Whereas what is modern Hollywood doing? The opposite. In his 1950 Nobel Literature Award acceptance speech, William Faulkner described the primary duty of authors as to remind men and women of the courage and honor and hope and pride and compassion and pity and sacrifice which have been the glory of his past. The study of great works of literature have always been considered foundational in education, stepping stones to success. English literature teaches appreciation for military valor, chastity and integrity, self-criticism, and the Christian faith are at the heart of Christian literature. Beauty and ugliness in our characters are exposed, along with our capacities for good and evil of the human mind and heart. Because we're fallen creation, there's evil in the best of us because we've fallen. But there's good even the worst of us because we're created by God. Fallen creation, that's the balance. Skill is admired. Achievement is extolled. The disastrous consequence of laziness and cowardice and foolish choices are exposed. There are an infinite variety of wonderful life-transforming lessons to be learned from English literature. Take William Shakespeare, for example. William Shakespeare's plays have universal appeal because of his intuitive understanding of human nature. Shakespeare's plays reflect the world as it is. Shakespeare evidences a comprehensive, accurate, and deep perception of the nature of things, especially human nature. Shakespeare's plays are delightful, breathtaking, real, and natural. He gives us characters who show us more about what human beings really are. When you see a Shakespeare play, you recognize the characters. You know them from your own experience, although his insights enable us to understand the characters better than ever before. Hamlet is so much more than a depressed and confused young man. He is self-conscious. He is sensitive to the moral failings of his elders. He's keenly aware of the implications of everyone's actions, but tragically he's unwilling to shoulder responsibility and to gain control over the events. In fact, he tries to run from his responsibilities. Richard III is a wicked king who resents other people's happiness and plots to ruin them for his own advantage. He is an outrageous villain whose schemes succeed for a time and then unravel completely. Like Kingdom for a Horse. Shakespeare's plays enable us to understand human nature, human history, and the things that human beings think about in a clearer way than any other playwright has succeeded in doing. Shakespeare's characters look at things from different angles. They don't merely consider the issues, they define the issues. His plays are full of famous speeches which focus at the heart of an issue. Each play seems to explore a major issue. For example, Hamlet considers death from every angle. Why do we long for death? Why do we fear death? What does it do to our bodies? What does it do to our souls? What do we know about death? It is a mystery. There are many ways that we can die. There are many reasons for dying. Hamlet includes a girl who goes insane and kills herself, a rash young man who throws his life away in a duel over his sister's honor, a scheming courtier who is killed as he eavesdrops behind a curtain, college friends who betray their schoolmate and conspire to kill him only to fall into their own trap, a fratricide, somebody kills his own brother, racked by guilt, Claudius cannot bring himself to give up his brother's wife and his brother's kingdom. Hamlet's famous to be or not to be speech and numerous poisonings, both purposeful and accidental poisonings, are also included in this extraordinary play. Or take Henry V, which is all about success and kingship. Small time, but in that small, most greatly lived this star of England. Fortune made a sword by which the world's best garden he achieved. What is a king? What are the qualities that make for greatness? How many parts generosity, courage, leadership, and humility? How many parts ruthlessness? What are the costs? Are not even the heaviest costs worth great achievements? The Merchant of Venice is all concerned about wealth. Every person, every incident in the play seems to have something to do with money. Antonio, a merchant who has grown rich by risky ventures in the trade. Shylock, a Jew who lives by lending money at interest, usury. Hoards coins and jewels at home. Shylock's daughter who elopes, taking large amounts of his wealth with her, wasting it like a prodigal. There are two marriages which are made, at least partly for money. Portia and Eris, whose father's will specifies that she can be awarded to the man who guesses rightly amongst three treasure chests. What a absolutely arbitrary, trivial reason to decide who's the best person to marry your daughter. Bassanio, a charming young man with large debts, promising, handsome, but a spendthrift, disingenuous, meaning dishonest, careless, he dares to ask his friend from whom he's already borrowed money he can't pay back for another large and very risky loan. There's a lawsuit over a defaulted loan in which the moneylender claims the right to cut a pound of flesh from the merchant's chest. You've heard of, you know, he wants his pound of flesh. Well, Shylock actually wants a literal pound of flesh literally cut out of the man's chest. And this play includes poetry concerning wealth and treasure. Where does wealth come from? Where does it go? What does it mean to men? What does it mean to women? What does it mean to the relationships? Now, these sort of themes are the bones and the muscles underneath the surface of the drama in a Shakespearean play. Shakespeare is an expert in the common fundamental laws of human nature, and he plainly drew from his plays from the actual structure of human experience. That's why so many of them actually are historical. Shakespeare prods and pokes at reality. He throws characters, events, and ideas together and makes them combine in every possible way. He shows how ambition tends to work differently in men and women. He exposed the ugliness of human greed and lust and violence and envy and betrayal. Whereas, today, in most Hollywood films, these are the things that are glamorized. Macbeth exposes what unbridled, selfish ambition can do to a human being. Macbeth becomes a progressively more paranoid and isolated murderer. Lady Macbeth, who is all strength and confidence, resolve when she's provoking Macbeth to commit the initial murder, she cracks under the weight of the responsibility once the deed is done. The tyrant's crimes set in motion destructive forces that will ultimately overwhelm him or her. Othello is focused on lust and jealousy. Othello's ensign, Iago, envious of Othello's lieutenant, Cassio, deceives Othello into murdering his faithful wife, Desdemona, by persuading Othello that she has been unfaithful with Cassio. The play revolves around the nature and effects of jealousy, the green-eyed monster, which doth consume the meat it feeds on. It is also seen as a clear warning against marrying temperamental men of other races. King Lear is a profound play set in a remote past of pre-Christian Britain. King Lear abdicates his kingdom in favor of his two daughters, Goneril and Regan, who feed his appetite for affection with extravagant, insincere speeches, flattery. When they turn on him and reduce him to being a harmless, homeless wanderer in the wind and rain, he finds support from his third daughter, Cordelia, whom he had disinherited because of her failure to flatter like her treacherous sisters. The tragedy of King Lear centers on being deceived by insincerity and the failure of the most basic natural relationship between parent and child. And so, the life and times of Shakespeare, of course, a lot of his work was done under Queen Elizabeth I, Elizabethan era. A lot of people also speak about the Shakespearean era. And you can see the geography of where he sits, and Macbeth is set in Scotland. Henry IV, of course, and King Lear in Britain. Richard III in England. You can see all the way down to All Well That Ends Well, that's more like Spain on the Mediterranean. Titus set in Italy, The Taming of the Shrew in Italy, again, Romeo and Juliet in Venice in Italy, The Merchant of Venice, Twelfth Night. You can see all the way over to Othello set in Byzantine Empire, what today is Turkey, and Antony and Cleopatra, of course, in Egypt, Much Ado About Nothing, down in the Sicily area, and so on. So, going to Shakespearean play, you learned about history, you learned about geography, you learned about your world, you learned about human nature. It was very entertaining and very educational. Shakespeare's tragedies show some choices are inherently destructive. It's no wonder that Shakespeare is so shunned and slandered by so many liberal professors. Because Shakespeare repeatedly exposed the wickedness of fornication and adultery, the importance of premarital virginity, the shame of unfaithfulness, the foundational importance of Christian marriage and obeying the laws of God. No wonder English departments hate him. Shakespeare has pride of place in Poets' Corner in Westminster Abbey. Just take his play Hamlet, which was one of our Sedgwick books at school. Andrea was pointing out to us how The Lion King is completely modeled on Hamlet. You've got the Lion King who's murdered by his own brother and chased away the real heir to the throne into exile, and who has, when he goes into exile, murderers go after him, just like in The Lion King, the hyenas are sent to kill him as he flees. And while the correct prince, who should be ruling the throne and dealing with his father's murderer, is goofing off with his sidekicks out in the field, in the case of Lion King, Pumbaa and Timon. But in Hamlet, it's Rosenthal and Guildenstern, and they're kind of a bit of comic relief from the otherwise very serious plot. And how, while Hamlet is ignoring his responsibilities, the king appears in a dream, like a ghost appears to him, remember me, which of course is what happens in Lion King too. Remember me, and this vision, this dream or appearance makes him go back and to confront the wicked uncle in the case of Lion King Scar, but in Hamlet it's Cornelius. And so there's a whole lot of similarities. In fact, Andrea lists about 20 similarities between Hamlet and The Lion King. But I'd like to note something else as well, and that is when the lion is ruling, the savannah works well and everyone benefits. When the hyenas take over, it turns into a dust bowl. Kind of see some social commentary on South Africa since the ANC cancer government has taken over. Even the river dries up. I mean, nothing works. Everything's absolutely wrecked. And only when the lion, God's chosen king, comes back into rule and rules for the betterment of all. As the Lion King says, that the king must rule for the benefit of his subjects. And that philosophy as well, you can see that that's not the way the hyena sees. So there's some social commentary in there too. But anyway, the point was about Hamlet. Then take John Milton. I went to Milton Junior and Milton High School in Rhodesia. One of the greatest English poets, John Milton was a dedicated evangelical Christian. Milton was one of the most learned writers of literature. He studied for 7 years at Cambridge University. He then completed 6 more years of postgraduate studies. He became fluent in Latin, Greek, Hebrew, and Italian. He knew all the great literature in all those languages, and he studied philosophy, theology, maths, music, history, and science. He traveled throughout Europe, and he met many of the great minds of his time. During the English Civil War, Milton was a leader in the Puritan forces fighting for Parliament against the wicked King Charles. John Milton served as Secretary for Foreign Tongues under General Oliver Cromwell. Well, obviously, he could talk almost anyone's languages. He was a perfect person to deal with ambassadors and foreign correspondents and so on. John Milton wrote Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained. To Milton, the most important events of history were the events of the Bible. The central drama of human life is temptation. The highest form of heroism is patient resistance to temptation. Comus, a play written by Milton, centers around the temptation of the lady, a 15-year-old daughter of an earl. Comus exalts temperance and chastity as essential for our safety and happiness. We fail by giving in to temptation. We rise by resisting temptation. Despite personal tragedy in his own life, losing his sight by his mid-40s, being publicly disgraced and impoverished by the restoration of the monarchy under Charles II, Milton epitomized the heroic ideal by patient endurance, enduring affliction and unjust abuse. He wrote, "Who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best." Now, the yoke may not be that mild, but he called it mild. The opening lines of Paradise Lost declare, "Of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree, whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe, with loss of Eden till one greater man restore us and regain the blissful state." Milton's works show how obedience to God can be heroic and liberating. He exposed the ultimate folly of giving in to temptation. Milton shows that Disobedience, which begins by looking so attractive, is ultimately selfish, squalid, degrading, destructive, and doomed. Just as in Paradise Lost, where he focused on the fall of Adam and Eve, in Paradise Regained, Milton focuses on Christ's victory over temptation in the desert and his triumph over sin, Satan, death, hell, and the grave at the resurrection. Even when he is a key figure of the victorious parliamentary forces, John Milton championed the freedom of the press. It's a fact of history that freedom of speech and freedom of the press were not invented by liberal Enlightenment rationalists. No, it was Puritan Christians of the English Protectorate who pioneered the concept of freedom of the press. Milton argued for a wide range to publish opinions, even erroneous opinions. When the Puritan Parliament was triumphant over all its enemies, all powerful in England with the new model army in power, John Milton addressed the members of the House of Commons, urging them to decide for free speech in the midst of all your victories and successes. To Milton, truth is so important, you cannot afford to miss the opportunity to learn from some piece of it which you may never see under the light of day under the restrictions of government censorship. Anyone who thinks that the work of Reformation is complete betrays that he is still very short of the truth. Censorship hinders the work of truth seekers. Milton explained that it is our duty to sift through different opinions, to test them, to find what is right. All opinions, yea, errors, learned, read, collated, of main service and assistance toward the speedy attainment of what is truest. Even bad books may be useful for a truth seeker, to the discreet and judicious reader. So Milton taught that even errors can be used to confute, to warn, and to illustrate, which is why we have a lot of bad books in our library, including the Quran, Book of Mormon, Marx's Communist Manifesto, and other, because we've got to understand our enemies to be able to defeat them. We live in a world where good and evil grow up together almost inseparably because God wants human beings to be free. But the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. For God sure esteems the growth and completing of one virtuous person more important than the restraint of 10 vicious persons. As a champion of freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of worship, freedom of conscience, freedom of the press, and as an unparalleled poet, John Milton and his epics Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained testify against the dangers of societies exiling religious truth from the public marketplace of ideas. Truth does not fear investigation. Jane Austen is widely recognized as one of the greatest English writers of all time. No other writer so often compared to Shakespeare. Jane Austen has been described as the most perfect artist amongst women, the writer whose books are immortal, and the greatest female writer in English. Hard to imagine anybody who could compete for that title. Jane Austen, born the 16th of December, 1775, just as America was beginning its rebellion, War of Independence, as you might want to call it, and she died 18 July, Bastille Day, 1817, just after the Battle of Waterloo and the end of the French Napoleonic Wars. Jane was the seventh of eight children. She had six brothers and only one sister. And interestingly enough, Kate Middleton, the future queen, is related to Jane Austen through their common ancestor Henry Percy. Her father, Jane Austen's father, Reverend George Austen, was an Anglican pastor at Steventon and also nearby congregation of Dean. For the first 25 years of Jane's life were spent in the manse at Steventon, pictured here, with her six brothers and sister Cassandra. Their home was also the local parish school, so she was brought up in a crowded, busy home with a lot of distractions. However, her father recognized the skill in writing, so he gave her a portable wooden desk, which could open up and serve as a portable office, almost like a suitcase, but it served that you could even put it on your lap if there wasn't a table around to work on it. Yeah, sort of like an easel for an artist. This is just this more compact one for an author. It contained drawers and compartments for writing materials. Remember, quills, sharpeners, ink bottles, and manuscripts. Wherever Jane went, this portable writing station went with her. And in 1801, the Austen family moved to Bath, and after father's death in 1805, his widow and daughters moved back to Hampshire. Her first published book was Sense and Sensibility, published in 1811, something like 15 years after she had written it, which was followed by Pride and Prejudice, which she had initially named First Impressions. So glad they changed the title, published in 1813. This was followed by Mansfield Park, Emma, Northanger Abbey, and Persuasion, were both published posthumously after death the next year in 1818. Her use of biting irony and realism and humour and social commentary have earned her great acclaim amongst critics, scholars, and popular audiences. Like, she was a trendsetter. She is the first to write books like this. This is apps, and today there's many people trying to imitate it, but she was the innovator. Jane Austen was recovering from a broken heart when she wrote her original draft of the book Pride and Prejudice. Her suitor could not afford to marry her, and he moved away. She never found a love to match her first love, and therefore she never married. Jane Austen spent her whole life financially dependent on her father and her six brothers, sharing a room with her sister Cassandra, writing her novels in a general sitting room subject to every kind of interruption, and there were many. Jane Austen was a genius, whose novels present some of the most extraordinary insights and commentaries in society and the most extraordinary understanding of human character. This is not just for girls to read. All males benefit from reading Jane Austen. It is understandable why many politically correct radicals would want to distort or ignore Jane Austen's literary contributions, because Jane Austen is so obviously a conservative Christian whose novels celebrate marriage in a patriarchal society. The opening line of Pride and Prejudice is easily recognizable, famous quote. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. Sets the tone of the whole book. And these are some of the contemporary illustrations that accompanied some of the more expensive editions of the book, because bear in mind, if you wanted color print, they had to by hand add the color. Artists sat there in a sort of assembly line adding color, because the printing machines at that time could not do color. Jane Austen's novels encourage men to take charge. The male tendency to not take responsibility, to keep the options open, to not get involved, is what makes young men so dangerous. The villains in Jane Austen's novels are generally the men who don't stick around. The male tendency to avoid or weasel out of commitment creates havoc. Desertion from duty leads to disaster. Or to think of the typical ending to how many Western novels or films, the cowboy gets on his horse and rides off into the sunset alone. And, you know, that kind of highly irresponsible male tendency is what Jane Austen destroys. Jane Austen recognizes the stubborn realities of male and female psychology. She takes her religion very seriously and finds it completely natural that men and women should occupy gender-specific roles. And by gender, she's referring to two genders, and only two. She accepts that human misery is caused not by traditional societal rules and structures. No, misery is caused by individual sin and dereliction of duty. Flying in the face of politically correct feminist rhetoric and egalitarian dogma, Jane Austen novels portray the failure of female self-control on the one side, and on the other hand, male abdication of their proper responsibilities. It's these failure to do one's duty that leads to the chief causes of people's unhappiness. Her novels celebrate old-fashioned marriage, in which a woman can be expected to be guided and protected by her husband and be responsible for the management of her household and the nurture of her children as her most intense source of fulfillment. In other words, Jane Austen was a right-wing extremist. This is what they depict these days as right-wing extremism. Husband who provides and protects, woman who nurtures and loves, going to church, Bible in hand, raising children, the girls are dressed like girls, the boys are dressed like boys. This is the ultimate enemy of the feminazis of today. Jane Austen happily pokes fun at every kind of superficiality, pretense, and hypocrisy. Her novels are full of women who are too free with their tongues, such as the embarrassingly vulgar Mrs. Bennet in Pride and Prejudice. Mrs. Bennet's gossip about her eldest daughter's success with a rich young man, Mr. Bingley, and that determines that man's friend, which is Mr. Darcy, to get his friend out of the neighborhood and break her daughter's heart. Numerous female characters' habits of selfish whining makes their families miserable and causes untold suffering. Lydia Bennet in Pride and Prejudice so violates accepted social customs and good sense, not to mention God's law, she ends up dependent on relatives and friends needing to bribe her seducer to marry her. One of the illustrations in early editions of Pride and Prejudice. Lady Catherine de Bourgh in Pride and Prejudice is a rich widow clearly spoiled by too much money. Elizabeth found that nothing was beneath this great woman's attention, which could furnish her with an occasion for dictating to others. Then you get Emma, the matchmaker and the manipulator. Emma Woodhouse, although handsome, clever and rich, only 21 years old, is spoiled, not only because of money and good looks, but because her affectionate, indulgent father is a hypochondriac who does not have any energy left to give her the guidance and direction she clearly needs. Emma is in danger of ending up as an interfering, bossy old dragon-like Lady Catherine de Bourgh as she amuses herself with matchmaking. Because Emma is blessed with more than most young women could possibly want, more intelligence, more freedom, more money, more good looks, and without the needed constraints from her parents, she's always used to getting her own way, and she mercilessly interferes in other people's lives. Emma chooses to adopt Harriet Smith to manipulate, rather than Jane Fairfax. Jane Fairfax is of Emma's own class, because Jane is just as intelligent as Emma and much more accomplished. So Jane Fairfax would remind Emma of her own few faults, whereas Harriet gives Emma endless opportunities to indulge herself in condescension and advice and to bask in Harriet's uncritical gratitude. You're not left to doubt what people's motives are in any of Jane Austen's novels. She analyzes and exposes it fully. Emma falls to the temptation to enjoy Harriet's blind flattery rather than to make the effort to live up to a real friendship with a girl who's her equal. Laziness and pride almost destroy Emma. Now, there are many spoiled men in Jane Austen's novels, too. These men are not the feminist villains of those who attempt to dominate women. Jane Austen's male villains are those who shirk their responsibilities and do not involve themselves and have failed to take charge. Mr. Elton humiliates Harriet Smith in public in order to please his vulgar new bride. John Dashwood allows his selfish wife to persuade him to break his promise to his dying father to take care of his sisters. Mr. Bennet in Pride and Prejudice fails to be an effective father, retreating into his library in a sardonic sense of humour to escape his ridiculous interfering wife and the daughters he lets run wild. Mr. Woodhouse is so weak that it does not even occur to him that he has a duty to guide his daughter Emma. Sir Thomas Bertram of Mansfield Park is a strict parent, but he fails to adequately interfere to the extent of teaching his daughters the necessity of self-denial and humility. Most seriously allows his daughter Maria to marry a worthless man who he knows does not love her, just because he's reluctant to scrutinize her motives too closely. Jane Austen exposed the tendency of men to fail to take responsibility and to, in each of her novels, there's at least one man who pays women the kind of attention that he should not unless his intentions were serious, which in these cases they are not. In Sense and Sensibility, Marianne Dashwood, seriously hurt by her experience with passionate Jean-Jacques Rousseau naturalism, finds refuge in religious principles, conventional standards, and traditional family values. She marries with no sentiments superior to strong esteem and lively friendship. She settles for much less in a marriage than she'd once hoped for, because she's seen how disastrous it can go if she tries to go the Jean-Jacques Rousseau follow your heart nonsense. Having seen where blindness to the cold, hard facts of human nature had almost taken her, she recognizes how much worse it could have been. Such is the case of the already seduced, pregnant, abandoned other girl who is love with her almost lover. And so, Jane Austen's novels are full of real life and real people and insights. And traditional marriage. Feminists hate Jane Austen, or they have to reinterpret and deconstruct her to be what they are and not what she plainly was. Jane died in Winchester, aged just 42, after a year-long debilitating illness, and she's buried in Winchester Cathedral, and more people visit the cathedral to visit her grave than for any other reason. So she's the most famous person in Winchester Cathedral. she's left behind a tremendous amount of great books. If a book is well written, I always find it too short, says Jane Austen. There's a whole collection of BBC films on her books, some of which are really good and true and faithful to it, and others may be less so, some are very modern. When you start getting Americans playing Jane Austen, you know you're in trouble. But they've even got Indians. India loves Jane Austen. There's a lot of Jane Austen. In fact, if you want to get some lectures on Jane Austen and Charles Dickens, you can find the internet lectures being given by Indian lecturers and so on. India very much is into these cultures, and they like Charles Dickens and Jane Austen. There are people who, the more you do for them, the less they'll do for themselves, said Jane Austen. This is the very opposite to a socialist. She does not believe in free anything. This is the Jane Austen House. It's a museum. This is where people can go and see a lot of the displays and personal items and pictures and details about her life. Britain has honoured Jane Austen with pictures like these, depicting her books, characters in her books, in postage stamps. The Bank of England even produced a note honouring her, £10 note. I declare that, after all, there's no enjoyment like reading. And that's something meaningful to put on your money note. The Victorian reaction to the excesses of Romanticism were also seen by Romanticism. We don't mean romantic novels. We mean the Romanticism in the sense of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, where the noble savage, and the less clothes you wear, the more more noble you are, and the more clothes you wear, the more evil you are, and that Christianity is evil, but the noble savages are the cannibals living on the beach, wearing nothing, eating the neighbors. That's what we mean by Romanticism. The Victorian reaction to this is seen in Alfred Tennyson and Robert Browning and Matthew Arnold and George Meredith, Gerard Hopkins, the Bronte sisters, Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre, George Eliot and Charles Dickens. So we come to the fourth example of a great English author, and that's Charles Dickens. Born 1812, died 1870. One of the greatest novelists of the Victorian era, and some would say of all time. Charles Dickens was born the 7th of February 1812 at Landport, Portsea Island, Portsmouth, the second of eight children of John and Elizabeth Dickens. His father worked for the Royal Navy as a pay clerk. See up here, it's got Charles Dickens was born here, and this is a Charles Dickens Museum at his place of birth. One of his favorite books as a young boy was Robinson Crusoe. Charles experienced a few years of private education, including at a school run by a dissenter, William Giles, in Chatham. Mounting debts and living beyond his means led his father, John Dickens, into Marshalsea Debtors' Prison in Southwark, London, in 1824. Charles was then just 12 years old, and he was forced to work in a blacking or shoe polish factory to help support the family. I mean, you get in a debtors' prison because you can't pay your debts. You won't get out until you've paid your debts. But how do you pay your debts if you're in prison? Well, child labor was very common, and so the 12-year-old had to go out and earn enough money to get him out of prison, basically. It's said that David Copperfield is the closest thing to a biography you can get of Charles Dickens, although he did not say that, but it's based obviously a lot on his character. In this, he's got this illuminating quote: "My father left me a little collection of books in a small room upstairs to which I had access and nobody else in the household ever troubled. From that little blessed room, all these great books and Don Quixote and Robinson Crusoe came out, a glorious host to keep me company. They kept alive my fancy and my hope, something beyond my place and time." At age 21, Dickens began working as a parliamentary reporter. He submitted short stories and articles to local papers and magazines. He travelled across Britain to cover election campaigns for the Morning Chronicle. He became a court reporter. In 1836, Charles Dickens became editor of Bentley's Miscellany. Dickens was a pioneer of serialized fiction, incorporating accessible, affordable series of regular cliffhanger stories, making the next new episode widely anticipated. And so to understand Charles Dickens, you've got to understand, first and foremost, he was a journalist. And with reports of American fans waiting at the docks at New York Harbor shouting to the crew of an oncoming British ship for details on how the next episode in a Dickens novel turns out. That's how anticipated the results were of his serials, which are normally a chapter a month coming out in newspapers. Charles Dickens was a crusading social reformer. He was against the debtor's prison, obviously, the workhouse, obviously, and other abuses in Victorian society. However, as an astute observer of human nature, Dickens exposes the faults typical of liberal thinking as well, scathingly. Charles Dickens' novels illustrate the unintended consequences of liberal actions. Every set of choices set in motion a complex chain of events that nobody could have foreseen, let alone control. Good and evil deeds have long shadows. The ultimate effects of actions are determined more by the intrinsic nature of the acts themselves than by motivation itself. Doesn't cut any ice. The fact is, there's always unintended consequences. All actions have consequences. Deeds of greed and cruelty have devastating consequences. The end does not ever justify the means. It is never right to do evil that good may come of it, which of course is the heart and soul of liberalism. In his Hard Times novel, Dickens not only depicts the conditions of factory workers, but he exposes the destructiveness of modern experiments in so-called education as well. In Dickens' Bleak House, there's a Mrs. Jellyby, who loves the Africans so much, she neglects her own family. She even persecutes her own children in pursuit of a high and compassion ideals to strangers. Her children wish that they could have been born black, that their mother might love them. But the mother has no love for her own children. She loves strangers far away. Her children become casualties of the revolutionary era, in which large projects for the betterment of the human race crowd out traditional individual responsibility and absolute moral standards. When Oliver Twist was published in 1839 as a book, young Queen Victoria read it. She stayed up until midnight to discuss it. As with most of his later books, Oliver Twist was first published in monthly installments as a newspaper before being published in a complete book. Dickens' first successful novel, before this, some say this was the second novel because the Pickwick Papers came out earlier, but the Pickwick Papers never had a print run of more than 400 before this, so this is his first successful novel, really. So some people argue whether it's the first or the second, but most people don't know about the Pickwick Papers, but Oliver Twist, almost everyone knows about. It shocked readers with its images and insights of crime, poverty, and the criminal underclass of industrialized London, which was a revelation to most people. Most people were not aware, but the court reporter journalist knew about these things. His novels have been accredited with literally changing public opinion on a vast amount of social issues. Some asserted Dickens communicated more political and social truths than all the politicians, publicists, and moralists combined. So Oliver Twist, his first real novel, was first published in a monthly series from 1837 to 1839 and then published as a book. The story centers on orphan Oliver Twist, born in a workshop, sold into a friendship with an undertaker. Oliver's mother, Agnes, dies in childbirth, the father mysteriously absent. Oliver spends the first 9 years of his life in the care of a Mrs. Mann. Names in Dickens are always very appropriate. With little food and very few comforts. Oliver was removed by Mr. Bumble and sent to the workhouse, which was, you could say, charity with a vengeance. Where this famous scene of, sir, may I have more? More? Oliver Twist exposed the cruel treatment of many orphans in London in mid-19th century industrial revolution, the kind of environment that Henry Morton Stanley was abused in. The alternative title, or subtitle, The Parish Boy's Progress, alludes to Bunyan's The Pilgrim's Progress. Charles Dickens exposed the abuses of his time, child labour, and the recruitment and abuse of children as criminals. The presence of street children and the nefarious activities of the gangsters who exploited them, including Fagin. Oliver escapes and travels to London where he meets the artful Dodger and a member of a gang of juvenile pickpockets led by the criminal Fagin. In popular culture, Fagin is now used as a term for adults who abuse children for illegal activities. Fagan is a miser who, despite the wealth he's accumulated, does nothing to improve the squalid lives of the children he abuses and exploits. He doesn't even do anything to improve his life. He beats the artful Dodger for failing to bring Oliver back when Oliver had just been arrested by the police. I mean, how on earth could the artful Dodger stop that? Fagan indirectly but intentionally causes the death of Nancy by falsely informing Sykes that she had betrayed him, whereas in reality Nancy had actually shielded Sykes from the law. As a result of Fagan's scheme, Sykes kills Nancy. When Dickens was accused of anti-Semitism for identifying Fagan as a Jew, Dickens wrote that as a court reporter, he had extensive knowledge of London's street life, and it unfortunately is true that that class of criminals almost invariably is a Jew, running prostitution gangs, child gangs and all of that. He said, well, that's the way it is. In fact, the Fagan character is based on a specific notorious Jewish criminal of the era, Ikey Solomon. Pressure from Jewish bankers required the deletion of over 180 instances of Jew from the text of Oliver Twist for later editions. Ikey Solomon was shipped off to Australia, and here you can see New South Wales needing to deal with him at a later date. Here's an illustration in the original Oliver Twist of Fagan in prison awaiting his execution. Nancy is a victim of domestic violence and psychological abuse at the hands of Bill Sykes, who ultimately murders her. Nancy was recruited, indoctrinated, groomed, and trained as a child by Fagan. And Fagan is the ultimate controller of child criminals and groomer of women into prostitution, taking children, putting them into prostitution. Yet, Nancy comes to repent of her role in the kidnapping of Oliver Twist and takes steps to try to atone for her partner's crime. Nancy redeems herself at the cost of her own life, and she dies in a prayerful pose. Dickens received considerable criticism for depicting a woman of the street in such a sympathetic way. Again, Dickens referred to actual case studies and individuals which he had encountered as a court reporter, which were an inspiration for the novel. He was basing these on actual cases, actual people. So Oliver Twist was a shocking indictment on the criminal class, and it literally shook England to the core when they discovered these things. It led to a lot of reforms and laws. No one is useless, said Dickens, in this world who lightens the burdens of another. In that case, referring to Nancy in particular. Great Expectations is a masterpiece by one of the world's greatest storytellers. Charles Dickens had already written 12 successful novels before Great Expectations came out. But Great Expectations exceeds the promise of the title. It includes a convoluted but thrilling storyline, unforgettable characters, heart-wrenching scenarios, and tremendous insights. Pip, a poor orphan, encounters and assists an escaped convict, Magwitch. Some years later, he is informed by a lawyer that he has great expectations because a mysterious benefactor will provide for him to become a gentleman. Pip assumes that the eccentric Miss Havisham is the sponsor, and that he has been groomed to marry Estella, Miss Havisham's beautiful adopted daughter, whom he's been regularly called to play with. As Pip abandons his humble origins to begin a promising new life in London, he falls in love with Estella, who treats him with callous indifference. In fact, she's been trained by Miss Havisham to do this because Miss Havisham was jilted at the altar by her beloved, her fiancé, and she's lived in her wedding dress ever since and kept the wedding cake, and she's a bitter woman, and she's crafting Estella to be a weapon with which to break men's hearts, as her heart was broken. However, nothing's quite as it seems, and when a strange visitor reveals the true identity of his benefactor, Pip is horrified. Now his real education through adversity leads him to the true nature of his great expectations. Dickens and novels are never straightforward. His characters are never straightforward, and neither are Jane Austen's. They always have so much depth. I've been bent and broken, but I hope into a better shape. Then there's The Christmas Carol. Dickens' story of the spirit of Christmas past, Christmas present, Christmas future has been dramatized on stage and screen dozens of times, and it never seems to lose its impact. Dickens wrote A Christmas Carol in just 2 months. The miserly Ebenezer Scrooge, has wealth but little joy in his life. This is in contrast to the Cratchit family, who are poor in the things of this world, but rich in family love and spirit and meaning and purpose. On Christmas Eve, Ebenezer Scrooge is visited by the ghost of his business partner, Jacob Marley, in chains. Marley warns Scrooge that to help him avoid the same fate, three spirits are going to appear to him that night: the ghost of Christmas past, the ghost of Christmas present, the ghost of Christmas yet to come. Now, we're not particularly comfortable with this ghost story business, but that was apparently very common in Victorian England. Scrooge was offered a chance to change his wicked ways. And the whole tension of the book is, will he experience redemption? This novel by Charles Dickens was recently brought to screen as The Man Who Invented Christmas. And I don't think people realize how much Charles Dickens influenced the way people in the English-speaking world in particular celebrate and think of Christmas. His Christmas Carol has had an enormous cultural impact. Then there's Bleak House. Bleak House is a searing indictment of the convoluted legal profession in industrial Britain, although it seems more relevant and more applicable today than it ever was back in his time. Based on actual legal precedents, Jarndyce and Jarndyce is a long-running legal case, and that's at the centre of Bleak House. This novel helped support a judicial reform movement which culminated in the enactment of legal reform in the 1870s. There are three main stories interwoven in Dickens' style with characteristic warmth and humour. It's a bit of a slow start, but once you get into it, you can't let it go. This is just so gripping. The first is the case where young Richard Cartstone, who's a ward of benefactor John Jarndyce, but is exploited by ruthless predators and hopelessly trapped in convoluted, apparently endless, ruinous court case. Richard descends into poverty and ill health. The virtuous Esther Summerson, another Jarndyce ward, is pivotal to the second strand of the story. She apparently has some link to the aristocratic Lady Dedlock, whose sinister lawyer, Tulkinghorn, senses a secret which he tries to uncover. The lawyers are the villains in this story, by the way. There is also a murder which is doggedly investigated by Inspector Bucket. This is arguably the first murder mystery in English literature. It's been a very popular one ever since. Just think Agatha Christie and all the others. Sherlock Holmes. The third strand to the story is narrated subjectively by Esther. This is the first time a male English writer used a female narrator for a story. Bleak House is a unique narrative structure told both by a third-person narrator and by a first-person narrator. The first person is Esther. These narrative strands never quite intersect, but they do run parallel. It's quite unique in English literature. Bleak House is both a tragic story of doomed young love and a genuinely enthralling murder mystery, and a whole lot more than that. But it's also a stunning expose of lawyers who, far from upholding noble principles of justice, delight in extorting money out of the misery of their clients. It is a searing indictment on not just the judicial profession, but the cursed legislatures in the House of Commons who enabled these things to be so tied up that justice is denied. Dickens's descriptions of urban squalor and legal injustice were consulted and quoted from members of Parliament in the House of Commons during debates. Investigators on sanitary conditions of British towns and editors and social reformers all quoted from Dickens's books because they knew his research was so good, his facts were so... Imagine a novelist being used as a defining argument and evidence by parliamentary and municipal inquiries, investigations. And these are some of the pictures at the time that show, here's the hideous moneylender or the owner of the slum area coming demanding more payment from some poor widow, the people lining up to get their water in buckets, the way how poor people would be abused trying to sell some vegetables and things like that in some of the better parts of town, and the kind of housing that was building up in industrialized areas where people just had smog and smoke and dust and dirt and no greenery and no garden or anything like that. And then as photography started in the latter part of Charles Dickens' life to become more available, you could see some of the squalid environments in which people lived in. And again, in Bleak House, you get an excellent expose of it. These poor people sleeping literally in coffins, which they had to pay a penny a night or something to sleep in it. These were some of the, you know, people who on the streets, and that the coffins were rented out for accommodation at night. The children working to clean the chimneys, going up and down. They need small children to fit up and down the chimneys. Very, very, very dangerous work, which, of course, shortened their lifespan dramatically. The amount of soot they imbibed, many of these children died before they reached adulthood. And these workhouses, you can just imagine some of what's involved here. English legal historian Sir William Holdsworth, in his 1928 series of lectures, Charles Dickens as a Legal Historian, made a case for treating Dickens's novels, Bleak House in particular, as primary sources illuminating the history of English law. Again, just shows the quality of the research and the integrity of Dickens's novels that almost a century later, people could be referring to his works as foundational primary sources for history of English law. Have a heart that never hardens, and a temper that never tires, and a touch that never hurts. Tale of Two Cities, probably one of his greatest books. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. These opening lines of A Tale of Two Cities are some of the most famous and easily recognizable in literature, and it sets the tone for the book. A Tale of Two Cities is a story of contrast, of dramatic events that affected London and Paris. Those are the two cities. England and France, contrasting the fruit of Christianity in London with the disastrous consequences of secular humanism and revolutionary fervor, communism, if you like, in Paris. A Tale of Two Cities covers the full range of human experiences, love and hate, peace and violence, order and chaos, sobriety and drunkenness, compassion and cruelty, selfishness and self-sacrifice, hope and despair. The underlying moral message is redemption. All of this is weaved into a gripping human story of love and loyalty against all odds. After 18 years unjustly imprisoned in the Bastille, Dr. Manette is released and taken to England to start a new life with his daughter, Lucy. A court case brings them into contact with two very different men, Charles Darnay, an exiled French aristocrat accused of espionage, and Sidney Carton, a brilliant but disreputable and self-loathing barrister who's got a problem with drink. Darnay is saved by Carton, who casts doubt on the case of the prosecution. Both men love Lucy, but she chooses to marry Darnay, the French nobleman, and together they have a child. Years later, when Darnay learns that a faithful servant has been imprisoned in France, he feels he must return to plead the case of this faithful servant. But when Darnay is imprisoned and sentenced to death by the revolutionary mob, his family is drawn to blood-stained Paris, where they all fall under the lengthening shadows and threat of the guillotine. It is at this crisis time that Sidney Carton chooses redemption. In the final words of the book, it is a far, far better thing I do than I've ever done. It is a far better rest I go to than I've ever known. It was most appropriate that in 1989, on the 200th anniversary of the French Revolution, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher of Great Britain presented French President François Mitterrand with a leather-bound first edition of Charles Dickens' immortal classic A Tale of Two Cities book. When reporters at the G7 conference in Paris flocked to ask Margaret Thatcher's impressions of the French Revolution, the Iron Lady replied, "Well, it resulted in a lot of headless corpses and a tyrant." Prime Minister Thatcher had a sense of the momentous event, as this G7 conference had been scheduled in Paris to coincide with the 200th anniversary of the French Revolution. The Iron Lady's symbolic act of resistance was itself historic. Margaret Thatcher advised the French president, "Read A Tale of Two Cities. Learn why the French Revolution was completely unnecessary." And this is like a verbal slap in the face, you know. To the French, this is the sense of the country, the French Revolution. And Margaret Thatcher just took a pin to their balloon and popped it. That's why we say reading is an act of resistance in a landscape of distraction. And should we say disinformation propaganda? While they promised them freedom, they themselves are slaves of depravity. The middle letter of the middle verse of the Bible is Psalm 118, verse 8. It is better to trust in the Lord than to put your confidence in man. We have a choice between revolution or reformation. Charles Dickens enjoyed unprecedented popularity during his lifetime, and critics and scholars have recognized him as a literary genius. Fellow authors like Leo Tolstoy of Russia and George Orwell, author of 1984 and Animal Farm, and others have praised Charles Dickens for his realism, his comedy, his unique characterizations, and his social reform. He managed to change his world because he realized that the average person isn't going to be swayed by the facts. They need a lovable personality that they can identify with. And so he taught them a lot by taking them through compelling stories and characters that made people think, what if I or someone I loved was in this situation? And they grew to love many of the characters in these novels. And so got people to care about things they'd never have cared about otherwise. And he couldn't do this if he was just giving them a sermon or a lecture. He gave them gripping, entertaining books. But those books taught at the same time as they entertained. A brilliant, brilliant communicator, a social reformer, a journalist, and an author and a social reformer who used novels to change his world. He creates some of the world's best known fictional characters, and his novels and short stories are still read widely today. Against the backdrop of an often turbulent personal life, Charles Dickens wrote 14 novels between 1837 and 1870. When we say turbulent life, that included two of his children dying in his arms. And I think his sister. I mean, he went through some turbulent times. And of course, the Industrial Revolution itself was turbulent. Imagine having to go out to work at age 12 on your own while your father's in prison. He knew turbulence. He also was involved in one of the first train crashes, a fatal train crash where 10 people died on a train with him. It was a terrible accident. He is a gifted performer. In fact, this is something that most people don't know, that when he was considering being a journalist, he first wanted to be an actor on a stage, and he went to Drury Lane, if I'm not mistaken, the primary theatre in London, for an audition. He wanted to strive for the stage, and they said he had no hope of that, and he went into journalism instead, and what a good thing he did. But later in his life, he returned to this, or I wouldn't say returned to the stage, he'd never been on the stage, but later in his life, he actually started to make public tours reading his novels from the stage, and he would have packed audiences all around Britain and all around the United States of America giving massive public readings from his works. For example, one of his reading tours, I go on speaking tours, he went on reading tours, he would read his novels. One of his tours, when they adjusted for inflation, he got paid £1 million for one tour of America, the equivalent if you adjusted it to present day pounds. Just that's how popular his readings were. As many as they could cram into these biggest theatres and halls in any particular town would be filled. In America and Britain, super popular in America as well as all throughout the British Isles. His 1843 novel A Christmas Carol remains especially popular and continues to inspire adaptations for stage, theatre and film. And my personal favourite is the George C. Scott version of A Christmas Carol. Is absolutely outstanding. I will honor Christmas in my heart and try to keep it all the year. Oliver Twist, A Tale of Two Cities and Great Expectations have frequently been adapted to film, but I would say the only one of Oliver that I think is worth watching personally is the 1968 one. The George Mills, this is 1945 or was it 44? Great Expectations is probably the very best. Well, there's been a more recent one that's pretty good. With A Tale of Two Cities, the only one I've seen that's true to the book at all is Ronald Colman's 1936 version. Black and white, but absolutely outstanding. Absolutely. A cast of thousands. Massive. You've never seen the French Revolution depicted more impressively than in A Tale of Two Cities, the Ronald Colman version 1934, which is in our library as well. Although Charles Dickens exposed hypocrisy and formalism in organized religion, He honored the Lord Jesus Christ and was a Christian with deep convictions. He wrote The Life of Our Lord in 1946 to school his children and the family in the faith, which you can get an audio book. And by the way, virtually every one of his books, because they are past copyright, are available online in audio. So if you just want to download his audio MP3s or listen to it in the background, you can have his audio book. Some of his books are long, some of them up to 11 hours of reading, but you can get the whole audio ones for travel, and it's very accessible and helpful. Some have described Charles Dickens as the man who invented Christmas because of the enormous social impact of his Christmas Carol novel. In 1945, when Charles Dickens took up the editorship of the Daily News, he editorialized that his goal was the principles of progress and improvement of education and civil and religious liberty and equal legislation. In 1851, Dickens moved into Tavistock House, where he wrote Bleak House, Hard Times, and Little Dorrit in quick succession. Now, bearing in mind that he and his wife had 10 children, this is a very busy time. And sadly, this building doesn't exist anymore. They pulled it down. But if you go, they've got a plaque saying, Charles Dickens, the novelist, lived in Tavistock House near the site, 1851 to 1860. And then they've even got, there's now a medical center there, and they've got some of the original bricks of the house that they ripped down. I mean, talk about barbarians. No respect for historical significance. How dare they tear down Charles Dickens' house? But anyway, you can see some of the original bricks at least. Bleak House came in 1853, Hard Times in 1854, Little Dorrit in 1856. Dickens was a generous philanthropist who raised and donated vast sums for hospitals and children's homes. On one of his reading tours from April 1858, February 1859, he gave 129 appearances in 49 different towns throughout England, Scotland, and Ireland. But bear in mind, it's traveling by horse, cart, and train. Not easy travel. Long distances, not good roads. But well acclaimed and much appreciated. A Tale of Two Cities was published in 1859, Great Expectations in 1861. When Charles Dickens died, 1870, of a stroke, it was after a full day's work on The Mystery of Edwin Drood, which he didn't complete. Others have completed, and you sort of wonder, yes, but is that the way that Charles Dickens would have completed it? Talk about mystery. He was laid to rest in Poets' Corner of Westminster Abbey, along with Milton, Shakespeare, many others. An epitaph circulated at the time of the funeral reads, to the memory of Charles Dickens, England's most popular author, who died at his residence, Higham, near Rochester, Kent, 9th of June, 1870, aged just 58. He was a sympathizer for the poor, the suffering, and the oppressed, and by his death, one of England's greatest writers is lost to the world. Dean Arthur Stanley praised the genial and loving humorist whom we now mourn for, showed by his own example that even in dealing with the darkest scenes and the most degraded characters, genius could still be clean and mirth could be innocent. Pointing to the fresh flowers adorning the novelist's grave, Stanley commented that this spot would henceforth be a sacred one with both the New World and the old, as that of the representative literature, not only of this island only, but of all who speak the English tongue. And apparently this area in Westminster Abbey, which I've been past, was buried under vast amounts of flowers. People couldn't even get into Poet's Corner, which is not a corner as much as a chapel. He was so beloved. Dickens' novels include pictures, melodrama, arresting names for his characters, allegorical impetus, satires, striking settings, describing down to the minutest detail the personal characteristics and life history of his characters. As I say, Charles Dickens remodeled our psychological geography with extraordinarily revealing remarks and insights and characters in his novels. You know, you just have somebody at Christmas making some negative comments, people say, oh, humbug, Scrooge. Immediately he's defined the person who doesn't want to enjoy the spirit of Christmas with the word Scrooge. Others have noted that while Charles Dickens certainly drew on his childhood experiences, he was so ashamed and scarred by them. He would not reveal that this is where he gathered his realistic accounts of squalor. No time in his life did he allude to any of these things. Very few knew the details of his early life until 6 years after his death, when John Foster published a biography of him, did people learn his father was in debtor's prison, he was in the workhouse, all these sort of things. He never spoke about it. He was ashamed of it. Dickens gave to the world compelling storylines and unforgettable characters which confronted social justice issues and frequently led to legislation and action to correct injustices in society. Charles Dickens is one of the most popular novelists of his time. He remains one of the best-known, best-read English authors of all time. His works have never been out of print. They've been continually adapted for the screen, with at least 200 dramatic films and TV adaptations counted based on his works. I'm sure there's more if you go to India. In a UK summary or survey carried out by the BBC in 2003, 5 of Charles Dickens' books were named in the top 100 English books of all time. 5 by one author. You know, to make the top 100 list of all time is really impressive. There's a lot of English authors. But he gets 5 books in it. In 2002, Charles Dickens was voted 41 in BBC's polls for the 100 greatest Britons of all time. One of the few people who actually deserved the title. Dickens and his publications have appeared on postage stamps throughout the world. Like here you've got Dubai. Who would have thought Dubai? Pitcairn Island? Wow. What's Pitcairn Island famous for? That's where the Mutiny on the Bounty mutineers went. And the Pitcairn Island Bible, the Bible of the Bounty ship transformed Pitcairn Island from a bunch of mutinous, riotous, drunken murderers into a modeled community. One Bible. Even Botswana had a Charles Dickens centenary stamp in 1970. And St. Lucia, and Turks and Caicos Islands, an Ascension Island. Wonder who could find Turks and Caicos Islands on the map, or the globe. And Jersey, a tribute to genius in 1912, the 100th anniversary of his birth. That's what stamps used to look like. And a first day cover of Charles Dickens, this ordered by someone in Thailand. Royal Mail first day cover. All his famous characters that you could immediately start to recognize, like Mr. Bumble and so on. And here's more of Charles Dickens' characters. British Virgin Islands, Centenary of Charles Dickens' Death, Tale of Two Cities, Oliver Twist, Great Expectations, David Copperfield, and a whole range. Dickens was commemorated in a series of £10 notes issued by the Bank of England between 1992 and 2003. Again, interesting. It's a good reminder to us, a nation that used to read books. In 2012, to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Dickens, the Museum of London held a major exhibition on the author and his books. And here's one of the statues of Charles Dickens in London. There's a lot of them around. Here's one of Dickens and Little Nell, one of his beloved characters. All kinds of memorials to Charles Dickens, including at the medical centre built on the site of where Tavistock House once stood. Here you can see the different things he wrote. Now, what you're most interested in is the novels. And so the novels are the yellow books. So you can see when they were written from. Oliver Twist is actually right out there. But just before is the posthumous papers of the Pickwick Club, which is these days called the Pickwick Papers. Okay, that came out beforehand, but total of 400 print runs, so that's not exactly to compare with Oliver Twist, which is a runaway bestseller. And where the others fit in Hard Times, Bleak House, Tale of Two Cities, Little Dorrit, Great Expectations, A Mutual Friend, Mystery of Edmund Drood. You can see, very busy. But then he also did Christmas books, 5 of them. He also did some stories, and then the Green Monster Histories, a Charles History of England. And there's quite a lot of his works here that we don't have, but that gives you a bit of an idea. Interesting here, when you get a summary of the great works of Charles Dickens, I'm intrigued by the fact that his first book, Oliver Twist, is not mentioned here. And I wonder why. There must be some prejudice of the controlling interest of some to try and wish that that book had never been written, could be forgotten. comparisons between Charles Dickens and Jane Austen. Interesting. For example, Jane Austen never saw publicity. Do you know, in her lifetime, she published the books under a pseudonym, so nobody would know that she's the author. They only used her name after she had died. Whereas Charles Dickens was a brilliant self-publicist and quite seeking publicity even. She wrote, Jane Austen wrote about three or four families in a country village with subtle characterizations. Charles Dickens is all about big cities and a huge amount of people and massive amounts of business and characterization. And he's far more the industrialized city. She's the countryside. Then also, whereas she never married, Jane Austen never married, Charles Dickens most certainly did and had 10 children. Born in Steventon, born in Portsmouth, both from the same shire of Hampshire. That's kind of interesting. Two of Britain's greatest authors came from Hampshire. And then both of them set scenes in Portsmouth, Mansfield Park, and also Nickleby. Both died young. Jane Austen at 41. Charles Dickens at 58, but bear in mind, in industrialized England, people's life expectancies were down there. You didn't live that old. So, obviously, while she is the author of the 18th century, or grew up in the 18th century, he was a man of the 19th century. So, here at the place where he was born, they've got ratepayers and resident association set up different plaques where he was born, where he lived, where he wrote, where he died. And this is the house where he was born. Pardon me. His desk, his writing tools, some of his actual books, kind of chairs he had. These are Dickens's books and works. First editions. And here's a complete set, not first editions, of Charles Dickens, hardcover. Everything from Old Curiosity Shop, Pickwick Papers, through Bleak House and Little Dorrit, see the whole way through. And a Charles History of England in the foreground. His desk was set looking out the window. The most important thing in life is to stop saying I wish and start saying I will. Consider nothing impossible, then treat possibilities as probabilities. I hope that real love and truth are stronger in the end than any evil or misfortune in the world. So, they're great books. There's some very good film adaptations as well to introduce one into them. If anyone has not read Little Dorrit, very worthwhile reading or getting the audio. And BBC even produced a very good, faithful rendering of Little Dorrit. And it's also available as an audiobook as well. Bleak House is quite extraordinary. There is a BBC film on it, which is surprisingly faithful to it and very gripping. And there's a whole BBC Charles Dickens collection. Evelyn Waugh pointed out that art whose only aim is to annoy and upset its audience is no art at all. Without the Christian religion, human beings are disgustingly selfish and shallow. The loss of the Christian faith means death for Western civilization. This may explain why so many politically correct English professors today have stopped teaching English literature. Those who are able to see beyond the shadows and the lies of the culture will never be understood, let alone believed, by the masses. And that's why the average liberals in universities today do not want to teach Dickens or Shakespeare or Jane Austen. Or Milton. Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, and whatever things are of good report, if there's any virtue and if anything is praiseworthy, meditate on such things. There's an interesting comment from Vishal Mangalwadi in the book that made our world how the Bible created the soul of Western civilization. In 1988, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher hinted at what would happen to a post-truth or post-Christian Britain. Pointing to the secret of Britain's earlier greatness, she said, "We are nations whose ideals were founded on the Bible." It is quite impossible to understand a literature without grasping this fact. That is the strong practical case for ensuring that children at school are given adequate instruction in the part which the Christian tradition played in moulding our laws, manners and institutions. How can you make sense of Shakespeare and Sir Walter Scott, or of the constitutional conflicts of the 17th century in both Scotland and England, without such foundational knowledge in the Bible? There is little hope for civilization if the hearts of men and women in society cannot be touched by a call to something greater than themselves. Political structures, state institutions, collective ideas are not enough. Healthy democracy requires the life of faith, as much to the temporal as to the spiritual nature and welfare of the nation. This is quoted from Margaret Thatcher by the Right Honourable Michael Allison, Member of Parliament in Christianity and Conservatism. The Iron Lady could have expanded in the common, now I'm quoting from Vishal in the book that changed everything. The Iron Lady could have expanded a comment about the source of British laws. The rule of law is a practical source of liberty. It's one of Britain's greatest gifts to the world. This is the cabinet room of the House of Lords. House of Commons is green leather. House of Commons has green leather. House of Lords is red leather. Ezra reading the law on the left, and in front, Moses bringing the law down Mount Sinai. That's the environment in which they decide the laws of the land. The Prime Minister and the Queen have power, but only to do good. They have no authority to violate a citizen's rights, for they are servants of the King of Kings. God is the King, God's children are kings or sovereigns in God's kingdom. As Britain's early political philosophers from Samuel Rutherford, next Rex, to John Locke realized, God's son gave his own life to God's children to give them eternal life. Therefore, providence gives to governments power only to serve their sovereign citizens. Now, Mrs. Thatcher could have easily gone beyond Shakespeare and English literature to discuss the creation of the English language itself. Again, I'm still quoting from this Indian man, Vishal Bangalwadi. It was literary England that made the Bible's worldview Britain's worldview. For literary English is a product of Bible translation, and the Geneva Bible and the King James Bible. Mrs. Thatcher realized that Great Britain's basic philosophical, ethical assumptions that words can and ought to communicate truth came from the Bible. Paganism, Buddhism, and postmodernism reject that assumption because they do not believe the word, the Logos, existed before humans did. If words, rationality, thoughts are products only of flesh and blood brain chemistry, then the best we can do is express our feelings, not the truth. If we're products of an accident, logic's impossible. Mrs. Thatcher could have gone on to explain that the Bible's logic-centric worldview makes Britain an educated thinking and scientific civilization. Without the Bible, Britain could not have become the birthplace of the Bill of Human Rights, a pioneer in compassionate scientific healthcare and the Industrial Revolution. Without the Bible, Britain could not have hurt its own economic interests by abolishing slave trade and slavery. Without the Bible, she could not have discussed family and the empowerment of women and children. For it was the Bible that prevented a British monarch from having more than one legal spouse. Its sexual ethic and philosophy of marriage required powerful monarchs to seek the church's permission to divorce a spouse. Mrs. Thatcher had to be brief, but the point she made is so profound that Vishal says he's writing a 4-volume work on how the Bible created the modern world. The relevant point is that the Prime Minister was not giving a new revelation. She's simply confirming what Britain already knew. At least historically it did. And so, at the coronation of the Queen, 2nd of June, 1953, Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, at the first filmed coronation, during the service, immediately after taking her oath of office, she laid her right hand on the Bible and said, "The things which I have here before promised, I will perform and keep, so help me God." The Queen then went on to kiss the Bible, signed the oath, and returned to her chair. Then, as the photo shows, the Archbishop of the Church of England and the moderator of the Church Assembly of the Church of Scotland presented the Bible to her, saying, "Our gracious Queen, to keep your Majesty ever mindful of the law and the gospel of God as the rule for the whole life and government of Christian principles, we present you with this book. The most valuable thing that the world affords, here is wisdom. Here is the royal law. Here are the lively oracles of God." All is quoted by Vishal Mangalwadi, author of the book this book changed everything. Picture of Queen Elizabeth with the Bible at a coronation. The Bible is the only force known to history that has freed entire nations from corruption while simultaneously giving them political freedom. So, any questions? Any comments?
I'd just like to go back to Charles Dickens. Considering his background, considering his poverty, considering his age, where on earth did he learn sufficient English to even write what he wrote?
As we read in David Copperfield, his father allowed him access to a whole lot of books up in the attic. And from those books he read Robinson Crusoe and dreamed of lives and places and times other than his own. So reading.
He must have read from his mother's knee, really.
Yes, but also remember right at the beginning there was that he had had the opportunity to go to a dissenter's school at Chatham. And so he had just a few years of some formal training in a one-room schoolhouse run by a dissenter. So obviously from his mother and but of course he was cut off from his family from age 12, effectively. He could only visit them in prison. So he had already had a good foundation just in those first 12 years.
Incredible.
Isn't that the power of reading? By teaching him how to read, giving him access to some books, and not that much schooling at all. I think it was like a couple of years at most.
Of school. Really unusual
person. Very. Yes. That's absolutely extraordinary.
If you think of David Livingstone also, his background.
Yes, although his upbringing was far more stable. He had a very stable home and stable family.
He was out working.
Oh, yes. Very poverty-stricken too. At least he never had the trauma of seeing his father put in prison for failing to pay debts. His family is poor, but he didn't have prison experience. So, just extraordinary that God could raise people up from that kind of extremely disadvantaged background.
So it's just possible.
And the Queen Victoria, called for Charles Dickens to come and do readings at Buckingham Palace and so on.
Charles Dickens did the reading in the various, travelling around on his reading tours. Do you know whether he read a whole book, a whole chapter?
He could not read a whole book. Because we know, I've got some of the books, and they go from anything from 4 hours for Christmas Carol or so, or is it 3.5, up to 11 and 12 hours when you're dealing with Bleak House and Little Dorrit. So that's the audiobooks. So he could not have read an entire book. No, all he could have done was read a chapter.
Now,
also.
Will he launching just the book so that people can buy it?
No. Yes, I think it would be. But he'd sometimes not read just a chapter. He'd read segments on certain points too. And people said it was spellbinding. Even people who've read the book several times came and said, but having it read by the author, they just had great appreciation. And you can imagine. So there was something in him of a showman. He must have. His first interest was, maybe I can get on the stage at Drury Lane. And he ended up on stage. In fact, he even organized his own performances. He directed some plays too. So there was that part of him too. But his first real serious job as such was as a journalist. So a journalist who really changed the world.
I also think it's very interesting the way Maggie Thatcher had tied in the religious side. Really, to Britain's history in such a strong.
There again, you've got a grocer's daughter. Mm. Someone who, as she would challenge her cabinet, how many of you know the price of, and she had mentioned anything in the grocery. She knew the prices. She kept tabs of it even when she was Prime Minister. And her cabinet members, not even a Minister of Finance, knew what the price of all these different basic items were, but she knew. She'd often be mocked as the grocer's daughter. And yes, I'm a grocer's daughter, and I know how the average person thinks and lives and what things cost. And that was the best Prime Minister Britain had in the 20th century.
Yes,
well, in my family, there's my daughter Andrea would probably say her favourite author is Shakespeare. My wife would certainly say Jane Austen. I think, while really think Jane Austen's great, if I had to choose, I'd probably say, for novels, Charles Dickens. he just really, and his Tale of Two Cities in particular, absolutely encapsulates the spirit of the times and the contrast between the fruit of Christianity and the fruit of revolutionary socialism. Absolutely powerful. But he had the patience to entertain people to educate them. I don't. I'm someone who writes about history or about a social issue and deal with it directly. But I recognize his audience was vast because he was reaching people who wanted a good story and good characters and good entertainment. And he did it. But he got the message through. And I've got to admire the patience of the man to be willing to do that. Because when I think of the enormous impact that entertainment can actually reach far more people than education can. I tend to generally stick in the realm of education, but you've got to look at a person like, Jane Austen, Shakespeare, or for that matter, Charles Dickens. They manage to impact people through entertainment, in a sense, but such quality. I doubt that most of what's being produced in our present time is going to be paid attention to a few centuries from now. you think of most of the junk from Hollywood. But Shakespeare and Milton and Dickens and Austen, they'll be regarded and considered through all time till the Lord returns. I can't imagine that you can improve on perfection much, but there may be better here and there. But I know that most of what we've got going around right now getting Academy Awards isn't worth much in the light of centuries.
Do you think
Queen Elizabeth,
at her coronation, the mention of the Bible, and her role really as a parent, it must give her a lot of agony to...
It must.
Did she fail in the rearing of the children?
It would seem, but I don't want to judge something I don't understand much. There was a book that came out from the Bible Society a short while ago in Britain called The Servant Queen and the King She Serves. And they, in this book, which I believe the Bible Society brought up, and I still want a copy, it's got in it excerpts from her speeches through the years, which is 60-something years as she's been reigning monarch. And her speeches have consistently testified to Christ and pointed to Christ and quoted from the Bible. And in terms of political leaders, no one has been reigning for so long who has so consistently lifted up a Christian standard. So we've got to say, in many ways, she's been an exemplary monarch, especially when you compare her with the other leaders we've had in the last 60-odd years. But as a parent, she's got to be very frustrated. That's got to be very troublesome that one's children turns out badly.
You showed, I saw Romeo and Juliet. Who wrote that again?
That is Shakespeare. Now, Andrea points out that West Side Story, which got the most Academy Awards of any musical in history, is totally based on Romeo and Juliet. Now, it takes someone like my daughter to say that because I've even watched a trailer for West Side Story. I'm not interested. But Andrea can tell you how so many successful films have been modeled on Shakespearean plots and plays, because it just shows how brilliant he was. If a person from 400 years ago could produce such plots that modern people, all the advantages we've got, are actually either adapting or cribbing, sometimes it's plagiarism without any attribution. But isn't that extraordinary that Shakespeare was so innovative and that 400 years later, they can look around and they think we can't find a better plot for our Lion King, for example, than to model it on Hamlet. Just and I haven't done justice to it as Andrea gave it, but just the amount of similarity. I think this cannot be accidental. This is just extraordinary modeling it. So you can see the impact these people have had.
I can remember very little of that movie, so I really must see.
Yeah. Well. Now, Hamlet, there's quite a few adaptations, one of them being a Mel Gibson one, which I remember came out in the 80s. But more recently, was Kenneth Branagh's. Kenneth Branagh did, what was it, 1996? He did one, moved on Hamlet, moved to the 19th century, set in Denmark. And that was extraordinary. And it's the only one totally unabridged, which means it's 4 hours film. Because that's a Hamlet is a four-hour play. Some of the plays are three-hour plays, but, I mean, some go up to 4 hours. Mm-hmm. Hamlet was something I had to study at school, and I had to see on a stage. I remember going to Weinberg, Maynardville, at the open-air theater, to see the Hamlet play there. And, of course, we had to do exams on it. So I really feel like I knew Hamlet well. But I've learned more about it from my daughter and her insights into Hamlet than I think I did while I was at school. So, any other comments, questions? I've got the notes for most of what I gave tonight. I've added a lot more from Charles Dickens, and the Charles Dickens notes are still going to follow later, but everything else I've put on Shakespeare and of Milton and Jane Austen is in there, but the Charles Dickens one's very incomplete. There's some other lecture notes as well from other things we gave during the week, which include some of the greatest books ever written and You Are What You Read and so on.
Maybe a silly question, but at the beginning of the lecture, you showed that image of a sort of generic modern English lecturer.
Yes.
Is that anyone specific?
I don't know anyone specifically. No. I didn't want to specifically put up anyone I actually knew.
Yeah.
I actually Googled a liberal English professor, and that's what came up. Yes, because I know a few characters I could identify, and I thought that might open me up to lawsuits, maybe. Yes. And my daughter, Andrea, went to a Christian university in America, Arizona Christian University, to study English literature, and even there, while it was mostly good, they injected things that had nothing to do with English literature under literature, which is just, I don't know what's going on in the English departments, but I'm informed that it's uniformly the worst department in any university. Because under English, they sort of, they run whole convoys of things that have got nothing to do with it.
No, I think it's clear after your lecture that they're trying to detract people from the clear messages that these books are sending out, you know, positive moral Christian messages, which they definitely do not want the students to. If you misdirect people to look at gender stuff or colonial or, you know, patriarchy or whatever, then the students aren't going to absorb those messages. They need to be directed at those messages, but they're not being directed.
No, right.
Yeah.
And this is the point. A person knows studying the English classics is key, so that's what they want to major on. Well, the last thing these universities want to do is teach you that, so they've got to distract you with all sorts of other things. But it's obnoxious. It's like going to Bible college and being taught everything except the Bible.
And the other thing is, and this is maybe also a silly point, but you said one of his houses, or one he was born in, was Tavistock House.
Tavistock House is where he did a lot of his publishing. That's where he had most of his 10 children.
Yeah, there's a sinister organization called the Tavistock Institute.
I have heard about it.
Social engineering kind of think tank.
I think they hijacked the name.
Yeah.
Because he had it. It was Tavistock House. I think Tavistock House became famous because of Dickens.
Yeah.
It could be groups who wanting to, just like, for example, Geneva was known for centuries as the place of the Reformation, John Calvin. And so where does the World Council Church put their headquarters? In Geneva. And by the way, who paid for it? 1945, John D. Rockefeller gave the World Council Churches $1 million, 1945 money, $1 million, to set up their headquarters in Geneva for the World Council Churches. Why would a pagan be interested in helping a religious organization, unless that religious organization could be or was already committed to helping New World Order? And so, and by the way, who particularly donated the land for the United Nations to build their nonsense in New York?
Probably.
Same man. The same man, Rockefeller. When you get the same banksters, criminals, financing the one world and the one religion, well, this is now getting to Revelation 13 sort of thing. One world government, one world religion, one world economic system. I mean, it's very disturbing. You don't need a conspiracy theory to see that being a problem.
But don't they know that they will die? I mean, they're not going to stay here forever anyway. What's the point?
Well, now you're thinking with wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. But people who don't fear God are not actually being very wise, as you say. I mean, it's not wise, because in the light of eternity, what they're doing is foolish. What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and he loses his own soul? Well, I think this is such important material. I've put a list of key books recommended. Well, of course, you can see I've just limited myself to four authors here with a bit of a racing through, but just to give an idea. But there's a lot of great, great material. We didn't even touch Pilgrim's Progress, John Bunyan, all these other great books here. But this is just to show what English literature is, and you can tell immediately this is not what they're teaching at the colleges.